do these lines, I write. I keep it live, cause I thrive. I might just blow your mind tonight. I'm so hyped, but it's no hype. From this height, it's direct hits on sight. I'm your type, lend me your ears to show you that there's something in me. I'm not giving up, I'm standing right here, holding these days hostage, and I'll make this my year. We turning fear into love, and the love's in the air. I love doing this cause nothing compares, nothing can share that same type of feeling when you feeling them flare. They can't catch it, it's havoc. I rip to a tear, switch the scenario. My stereos, I leave them impaired. Variables start to change, and they're all in my range. I just gotta grab it, it's all mathematics. Every step is drastic, I make it fantastic. I'm trying to take your breath away, asthmatic.
This is live through the stereo. Go and let it blow, blow through the stereo. I'ma let them know, no through the stereo. Yo, here we go, go through the stereo, stereo. This is live through the stereo. Go and let it blow, blow through the stereo. I'ma let them know, no through the stereo. Yo, here we go, go through the stereo, stereo.
Yeah. Just nod your head with it, so explicit and vivid. Every image is intricate, intimate. I put my all into it, no scrimmage and no rules. I'm a pro tool, hear my heartbeat beat into the vocals. I'm so loco, lost my mind, oh no. It's ponderoso, dope so, no overdose cause it's dope, yo. Man, this is house grown, mixed with some milestones. So I let the style flow, down like the Dow Jones. Bringing it with some foul tones, letting the crowd know we getting loud, so it's eardrum rudiments. Yeah, we bring it rude again. Move, little hooligan. Music for tuning in. Full time to the 10. I'm on my clock, like I told you. I'm doing this for dreams we pursue.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the Anti-Media Radio Show. Once again with your host, Nick Burnaby, here on UCY.TV. Thank you all for tuning in, and I'm really happy to be back with you. Just got done watching that awful presidential debate. Unfortunately, there's just very little context going into this debate, very little actual policy discussion. And again, it goes back to this idea that American politics has kind of descended into this rhetoric and like cult of personality, and you know, the Republicans versus the Democrats. It's like, oh, you know, it literally is just a war of personalities. That's what it's become, and it's just really horrible what is happening with our political system and stuff. But it's just, at the same time, in my opinion, it is very, interesting, because basically, you know, what I see going on is the system is exposing itself, you know, like, and that's what I think in you know, this election, you know, the two most hated candidates of all time. But in the end, it's kind of goes to show that something is wrong, something is broken. I don't want to jump on the Trump rhetoric here and say, you know, it's rigged, this is rigged, that is rigged. I mean, we all kind of know that one way or another, the whole damn system is rigged, and that's the whole point here. And that's kind of what the point is that I'm trying to get to here, is that the fact that we are stuck, you know, quote unquote stuck with these two awful, unlikable candidates shows you that something is broken in the system, something is wrong. And with these two awful, you know, two-party candidates, you would think that in a time like this, there would be an alternative, someone that you can maybe vote for or support that isn't so corrupt or isn't so crazy or isn't such a sociopath, like, you know, maybe Jill Stein or Gary Johnson or something like that. But because the system, the overall system, is so broken or so rigged, whatever you want to call it, it doesn't allow for that to happen. And that, to me, is what is like the only positive development coming out of this election. One of the only positive developments is that the American people, and I think the majority of American people at this point, can sit here and say, yeah, both of these people suck, and why don't we have more options? Maybe it's time to start thinking about figuring out how do we give ourselves more options, you know. That being said, thank you all for tuning in. Hope you enjoyed the debate, or at least gained some entertainment value out of it, because like I said, it wasn't much, you know, not much learning there. And if you were an undecided voter before now, I don't know, you know, if you're still trying to pick between Trump and Clinton, I feel kind of bad for you. But if if you were already undecided, I doubt this debate really, you know, fixed it for you. But that being said, we're gonna put together an awesome panel tonight to talk about the debate, talk about some other stuff. There was one point in the debate where a question was asked that we've been railing on. I wrote an article about. We talked about it all night on Monday night. And we had a video go up on yesterday afternoon about it, and the question was asked. And so that I was actually happy about. First time, at least in this debate, where a very substantive question was asked. Now, the candidates didn't really answer it very well, but at least it was asked. And so that I was pretty happy about. Anyway, that being said, let me introduce my panel. I've got my longtime co-host on the line, DB Schwartz. What's up, man?
Hey, Nick, not much. Just to touch on how it's absolutely imperative we have a third or fourth or fifth option. I just wanted to bring up super fast, there's a scorched earth type of strategy going on at OpDeny, OpDeny.com. It's kind of just a way to, if we can deny either candidate 270 electoral votes they need through whatever means necessary and force the House of Reps to choose, then it kind of goes on these reps, right? And these reps can't hide behind voting machines anymore. They have to actually make a choice. And if they would choose either of these candidates, they in turn would be voted out or probably recalled immediately. So it's a scorched earth policy, OpDeny, OpDeny270.com or whatever. Check it out. Because we have to prevent one of these two people. I mean, obviously, if we have to make a choice between these two, don't choose the one that's going to start World War III. But the other one's going to start Civil War 2.0, and that's not going to be fun either.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. That's something I've been wanting to talk about, and I actually read that even something as minuscule as one of the third parties winning one or two states could actually deprive both Trump and Clinton of the election, and that's really the only way right now that we have to move forward as far as denying either one of these maniacs, I don't know how else to describe them, depriving them of the election, you know. And so that to me is a fair tactic, I think. There's several tactics that I want to talk about tonight, but first let's bring in our awesome journalist Jake Anderson. What's up, man? How you doing?
I'm good. Yeah, just watched that debate. Everyone's freaking out, or CNN, their little echo chambers going absolute ape shit over the fact that Trump said he wouldn't necessarily honor the results, and I posted that I'm glad that he said that, because this system is a clown's autopsy, and if it takes a dead clown to point that out, then so be it. You know, I mean, that's how I view it. Whether there's specific election fraud, I'm not sure. It might be too big of a landslide on his side to flip it. But we know for a fact that 2004 had election fraud. So for these reporters to come out, I mean, it's this Operation Mockingbird 2.0. It is so entrenched and just embarrassingly obvious that it's almost just amusing to watch these people. I can't believe they can wake up in the morning and look themselves in the mirror. I honestly can't. DB, I just looked up OpDeny. I joined their Facebook group. Should I go to the site too?
Yeah, I mean, it's seriously like there's going to be a lot of detractors. There's a lot of HRC trolls that are kind of posing as diehard Jill Green Party people and saying, don't go to it, it splits the vote, and then Jill can't get the 5%. Jill's right. Going to get the 5% or not. Like, if people in these states that can write in Bernie or whoever, write in whoever, it doesn't matter. But write in somebody else so the electoral votes won't go to two of these clowns. Let's not live inside of a dead clown, and let's honestly make a mockery of this system if we can. People need to wake up.
Let's not be maggots in a dead clown. But there's two states. I wrote about it in something this week. But if Bernie might win Vermont through write-ins, and he's only down by 4 percentage points against Clinton and Trump, who are tied at 26. And then there's an independent who might win Utah.
Yeah, McMillan, who's isn't he like a former NSA?
Former CIA.
CIA. I mean, God, what does he have on people that allowed him to get through with that?
And The other interesting thing here is that Gary Johnson has a chance of winning his home state of New Mexico as well, which I read under certain circumstances would also be able to deny Trump and Clinton of the electoral votes needed to secure the presidency as well. So, you know, that's very interesting. A couple of the tactics I wanted to talk about was, as DB was mentioning with Jill Stein, getting these parties their 5%. I don't know exactly how they calculate the 5%. Do they have to get like 5% of the electoral votes or what? I'm not sure, but it is important, I think, to garner these third-party candidates, the 5% needed to become a quote-unquote major party, which kind of secures them. I think it's like $10 million in federal funding so that they could have kind of not a head start, but, you know, they have like startup funding for their campaign next election, and which would, you know, that kind of infrastructure, $10 million. I mean, I'd be surprised if Jill Stein has raised $10 million throughout this entire campaign. I don't think she's operating on very much money at all. You know, and so to start off with $10 million would be a good, you know, leg up to give these third parties a chance next election in 2020. Maybe there will be a viable challenge from a third party, especially considering how awful this election has gone and how Donald Trump is kind of dividing and conquering the Republican Party. And Hillary Clinton, by her own corruptness and her campaign staff and just all those dirty deals that she's done, whether it's, you know, rigging the primary against Bernie Sanders by skewing the media coverage, or just all these quid pro quo, pay-for-play things that she's now being caught with thanks to WikiLeaks. You know, Hillary Clinton is sabotaging the Democratic Party as well. And, you know, we've been talking about this, and especially DB and Jake, you guys have been talking about how there could be a split and from the Democratic Party to form a new kind of progressive alliance far to the left of the Democratic Party. Because, you know, the fact of the matter is the Democratic Party, you know, as the beast that it is, it's not on the left at all on anything except for several social issues like abortion, gay marriage, and women's rights and things like that. Other than that, I mean, the Democratic Party is the neocon party, and Trump has turned the Republican Party into the neo-nationalist party. And so, I mean, we're seeing kind of one of those, I think what we're dealing with right now is one of those times like in the 60s when the parties kind of shifted. And the Republicans went from the party of, you know, standing up for people's rights, and the Democrats went from the party of the KKK and all that, and there was like a shift. In the 60s, there was a shift. In the 70s, it was a whole new party. And that's what's going on right now, I think, with these two parties. But I think there's going to be a lot of people disenfranchised. Obviously, there's a lot of people disenfranchised that are going to be the pieces will be picked up by other parties that are maybe existing, like the Green or the Libertarian, or maybe new parties are going to form that are going to help pick up the pieces.
Nick, what I was going to say is I think these two parties were merged until a guy who was kind of not really a robber baron, but he's kind of a magnate. You know, Trump will lose everything if we go to war. His business is in physical collateral within the United States primarily. So imagine when collateral damage becomes every day. I mean, the guy stands to lose his fortune. And there are people on that fence. The people that are going with Hillary, that are going with any thought of a no-fly zone, these are globalists. They're just going to move their assets around liquid, you know, form, and they don't care if the world burns.
Yeah. So, you know, the other tactic here, now I would never condone voting for Republican or Democrat, even if there was decent candidates. I mean, you know, I've been pretty staunchly anti-main parties ever since 2012 when I saw what they did to Ron Paul and how the parties really are just, you know, it's just a big club and most people aren't in them. Now, Trump has kind of disrupted that a little bit, but that's why all of the institutions in the United States have lined up behind Hillary Clinton, because Trump isn't necessarily a party, you know, Republican Party player. I wouldn't call him anti-establishment, but I would say he's not the Republican Party. He's not the guy they wanted to run, so therefore they'd rather elect Hillary Clinton. You know, but I think depriving these two parties, and if you're you know, dedicated to voting are going to vote for president, I mean, voting for someone else, like Gary Johnson or Jill Stein, that's probably the more effective route to go. We covered an interesting story on the anti-media earlier today, and there's an interesting third-party, you know, quote-unquote candidate that's in the running, apparently, because Giant Meteor is polling pretty well among young people, and so that is kind of an interesting thing, and it brings us back to these kind of satirical candidates. And Jake, you've kind of written extensively on this as far as one candidate that was polling one of the best third-party candidates in modern history, which was D's Nuts at the early beginnings of the campaign. What do you make of these kind of satirical candidates? You know, the latest iteration of it is a Giant Meteor. You know, young people are like flocking to Giant Meteor. People have been polled and showed that they'd support Harambe if he, you know, the gorilla that was gunned down in the Ohio Zoo. What do you make of these kind of satirical candidates, and what does it tell us about the state of, you know, modern American politics?
Are you talking to me?
Yeah.
Well, I love it. I mean, yeah, I mean, when I was writing about D's Nuts a while back and Vernon Supreme and whatnot, I mean, I think it's more symptomatic than it is satirical. It's a symptom of where we're at. If it were simply satirical, it wouldn't go very far because I just don't think it would have very much power. I mean, people are always trying to make jokes out of elections, but when you actually have D's Nuts polling at one point at 9%, that's very real. I mean, when we have you know, write-in candidates that are actually polling, man, it just shows you. I mean, this is the fight to the bottom that we've been, you know, kind of dreading. But at the same time, for those of us who see the system as just completely corrupt and really not worth saving, in many ways, this is the best possible election we could have had, because it's exposing millions and millions of new people to how absolutely ridiculous it is. And I think that's a good thing. And, you know, it's gonna be some tough sledding ahead in terms of reforming it. I'm not even sure if it's possible. You know, the first thing that has to happen is for people to open their eyes and see it. I mean, nothing can change until that happens. So if this is what that takes, then so be it. And, you know, look, we have a person who's going to win who is mired in scandal, and literally every single day new emails come out showing how tethered she is to corporate entities and how tethered she is to a corrupt financial system and how you know, absolutely insidious her foreign policy has been. And yet we're led to believe that the threat to democracy is the guy who, you know, has a bad mouth and is probably, quite honestly, sure, he's a womanizer and he's probably abused people, and that's terrible. And I don't want Donald Trump to be president. But, you know, at this point, I never thought I'd say this, you know, he's on the right side of history on free trade, on military interventionism. With the threat that Hillary is putting forth to the no-fly zone, I mean, man, I don't know. but, sorry, I got distracted there. Back to your original question, the satirical candidates are great, and the Giant Meteor one is new. Do we know if that's, is that like really polling at anything respectable?
Let me check. I got the article pulled up here. Those looking to read the article, because it is a really good article too that is worth reading. Surprising third party candidate surges with young people just before election. Let me see what they're actually polling at. Giant Meteor is kind of preferred by 23% of millennials, basically, compared to Trump and Clinton. So yeah, 23%, pretty high. I mean, that's a lot.
I'm assuming his running mate is scorched earth. That would make sense.
Well, the running mate here, according to at the end of the article, is according to this poll, marijuana is actually much more popular than Clinton or Trump among millennials, pulling in at 58% supporting marijuana legalization. So, you know, marijuana meteor would be a great ticket. Marijuana meteor 2016 is the
among baby boomers. Preparation H is more popular.
Yeah, we better get started on that Preparation H, because H is about to get elected, and we better start preparing for what her no-fly zone is going to do. And that's the thing that I wanted to mention as far as this debate tonight. And that was really the only spot where I thought that the moderator, which was a Fox News hack, and I can't stand the guy. I've seen him on Fox News in so many clips before. And I what's his name, Chris something. I can't stand the guy. He's just obnoxious. But he asked Hillary Clinton. What was that?
I think you mean Where's Waldo? Or
Chris Matthews, or no, that's the guy on MSNBC. Chris something, anyway. he asked Clinton to talk about her comments on the no-fly zone because, you know, as I reported last week, and this really scared the daylights out of me because, you know, Clinton, in the last debate, she went around talking about, you know, nonchalantly how she wants a no-fly zone in Syria. And she repeated that claim tonight twice. But the fact of the matter is that a no-fly zone in Syria, according to the highest-ranking general in the United States, would start a direct conflict with Russia. And so I'm glad that the moderator asked Clinton to clarify that, and she never really answered it. But at least the people in the United States that were watching tonight, maybe now they know. That going around talking about a no-fly zone nonchalantly, like it's something that's easy to do or that it's something that we actually should do, now people maybe are starting to realize that a no-fly zone is actually a really, really dangerous idea in Syria. I mean, we got away with it in Libya because Libya had basically no allies, so we were able to just go in. It's a small country, very little military. We knock out their no-fly zone. We help assassinate the president. And we leave the country in complete ruins. Okay, it sucks for people in Libya. It sucks that Hillary Clinton kind of convinced Obama to go and topple the Libyan government. But that's, for the most part, confined to Libya. Yeah, it is leading to a mass refugee crisis and stuff that is probably going to come home to roost sooner or later. You know, and I think that Trump is actually right about that in some ways. I'm not anti-refugee or anti-immigrant by any means, but I mean, let's face it, you go and topple a country's government, there's going to be several people that are going to be pretty pissed at you and they're going to want to do bad things to you. You know, that could have been prevented by never going and toppling the Libyan government to begin with, but you know, it's already happened. But in Syria, it's a whole different story because the Russian government at all costs will defend the Syrian government. At all costs, I mean, up to and including the point of fighting a war with the United States. And it's not just Iran that's in there backing them, but it's also China. And China is a huge country, nuclear armed, billions of people living there, biggest standing army in the world. I mean, Nick, you don't want to start any kind of beef with China because you're done. You're mutually assured destruction. And, you know, the other thing is Russia's got enough nuclear capability to also ensure mutually assured destruction. So, you know, bad policy on the no-fly zone, and I'm glad Clinton finally got kind of asked about that because before she was given a complete pass. I mean, I was looking for when I wrote my article last week, which thankfully went viral. We posted a video on it yesterday, and you know that got 500,000 views, which I'm really happy about. But when I was writing the article last week, I was researching to see the coverage from the mainstream media about Hillary Clinton talking about this no-fly zone and the ramifications of it. There was literally no coverage. The only coverage I found was from media outlets talking about, yeah, a no-fly zone is a great idea. We should, you know, we should be pushing for Obama to create a no-fly zone. But the general sat there and told the Senate hearing that a no-fly zone in Syria is going to start a war with Russia, and that is something that we can't be sitting around and talking about nonchalantly like that and just acting like it's just, you know, just another day of foreign policy. It's not. It's not. It's not toppling some little government, some little country with no military. It's prodding you know, arguably the second most advanced military in the world, and you know, playing chicken with them and threatening a direct war with them. That's not something to be playing about. And Hillary Clinton being this crazy sociopath that really honestly just does not give a shit about human life can just walk around talking about that as if it's no big deal. It's the biggest deal in a long time. I mean, you know, Obama never had to deal with anything that big, talking about a no-fly zone in Syria. That is something, and that's why Obama hasn't done it. Obama, as bad as he's been on foreign policy, he's not reckless, and he's I don't think that he's that much of a sociopath that he doesn't give a shit about human life. Clinton has shown herself to not care about human life. In fact, as I noted in the article, and if I was on on the debate stage tonight, I would have nailed Clinton on this, because Trump is obviously clueless as to what WikiLeaks is actually talking about. Because according to what Clinton said to Goldman Sachs, according to what part of the transcript that WikiLeaks recently leaked, Clinton told the people at Goldman Sachs that if we put a no-fly zone in Syria, that we're going to have to kill, quote, a lot of civilians in Syria. Because a bunch of their air defenses are located in populated areas. So we got to bomb out their air defenses. They're in neighborhoods where hundreds of thousands of people live, you know. And so Clinton has already admitted in a speech to Goldman Sachs, which she wanted to keep secret, that if we did this policy, it was going to kill a bunch of civilians. So obviously she doesn't care about killing civilians in Syria. So she's going around selling us this Aleppo story, which, don't get me wrong, what's going on in Aleppo is a horrible, horrible catastrophe, and it could have been prevented, and it should have never come down to this. But Clinton is telling us that we need to have a big heart, and we need to put a no-fly zone because we need to stop these poor civilians from dying in Aleppo. The policy that she's advocating to stop Syrians from dying in Aleppo would require Syrians to die. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. But here it is, you know, that's what she gets away with. The media gives her a pass on the no-fly zone stuff. I mean, by all intents and purposes, the media loves no-fly zone, because the way they treated it in Libya was as if we're freeing the place up. We're saving Libya by creating a no-fly zone. Just so happened we knocked out the government and left it in pieces and let ISIS take over parts of the country and let the rest of it fall into a civil war. I mean, If that's bringing Libya democracy, I have no clue about anything in the world, because that it just doesn't make any sense to me. But you know, aside from everything else, that was the only thing in the debate that I was actually like, okay, I'm glad that guy asked that, because you know, I extensively wrote about this. We extensively talked about it on Monday. We had a video come out yesterday about it. So I was glad that got asked, because a no-fly zone in Syria is just asking to start a major war with Russia, and that's just something that I think would be probably the worst decision this country has ever made. Ah, man. Rant over. So,
I was just going to say, Nick, just to inject reality into what it would actually be, it's not even close to Libya. We really can't. We can't shoot cruise missiles to shoot down their cruise missiles. So we have to go in with ground forces. It has to be us, because none of our Arab allies, our supposed allies, are going to risk their own guys just getting completely massacred by the Russian military. So they're going to make us do it. They're going to make us be the point of the spear if we want it so bad, if we want that no-fly zone so bad. And I mean, you can't even, there's no, how many people have they moved over there, Nick? Didn't they say that we're already into the tens of thousands that have already mobilized over there? They're just doing it like 1,000 a time. I mean, we've got to be close to 30 or 40,000 troops already over there. So it's going to be an absolute bloodbath. I don't think people understand that.
There's U.S. troops right now helping to spearhead the assault on Mosul, which is, you know, Iraq's second biggest city outside of Baghdad. And, you know, Mosul is a very strategic place. That's where one of the country's biggest dams are. That you know, ISIS was in control of that dam, and they can cut off water to Baghdad, which is a giant, giant metropolis city. But yeah, I mean, we've already got a bunch of troops. According to what's the guy's name? General Martin Dempsey, which is one of the higher-ranking generals in the United States. He told the New York Times back in 2013. That it would require 70,000 American troops to go into Syria to establish a no-fly zone. And that was a couple years ago, and that was before Russia got involved. Russia has since moved in its S-200, 300, and 400 anti-aircraft systems, which are some of the most advanced anti-aircraft systems in the world. And, you know, Russia has modernized and fortified Syria's air defenses, which means that literally when Clinton talks about creating a no-fly zone in Syria, basically what she's saying is that we're going to need around 100,000 ground troops to go in there to secure this no-fly zone. And, you know, the guy asked, the moderator asked tonight if the candidates were willing to put boots on the ground to make sure ISIS doesn't retake Mosul if we're successful in taking Mosul back from ISIS. And I think, as far as I know, both candidates said they don't want to put ground troops. But Clinton is, you know, advocating a no-fly zone. She must be okay with putting 100,000 ground troops in Syria because that's what it would take. You know, and the way that these conflicts work, if you look back at, you know, throughout a long time, going back to like Vietnam even, where it just started as like, oh, we're just going to send military advisors and, you know, we're going to do this and we're going to do, you know, little by little, they call it mission creep. And that's what the U.S. has been doing in Iraq ever since Obama started putting troops back in there. As you mentioned, DB, it started off as like, I think it started off with like 300 troops because, you know, the U.S. pulled the majority of its military out of Iraq, even though we left 10,000 military contractors, like, you know, the Blackwater types and stuff. We left them there to make hundreds of each troop, each military contractor soldier. They make like hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. They get paid like five times more than our actual active duty, like army guys make. In fact, I know a lot of people that are like military veterans that are like, man, I'm thinking about like going and working for a contractor because I can make like, I can work for like 3 years and retire because I'll make like $1 million after like three or four years. You know, we left 10,000 of the contractors over there to protect mostly oil infrastructure and other kind of, you know, other kind of things like that, businesses and corporations and things like that.
One of my buddies is an ex Navy SEAL, and he's over there, you know, in Afghanistan guarding fields, and it's brazen, man. But it's $10,000 a month.
It's a lot of money that these guys make, dude. And so, you know, we had all those troops, but, you know, we had all those contractors in there, but so, you know, the contractors didn't do a damn thing as far as when it came to protecting Mosul or repelling ISIS and stuff like that. I mean, they were just in charge of keeping the oil field safe. Now, that's when the U.S. started taking ISIS seriously, because if you look back throughout Obama's rhetoric throughout this whole saga of the rise of ISIS, you know, Obama originally referred to ISIS as like the Al-Qaeda's JV team or something like that, something like ridiculous. It wasn't until ISIS started taking Mosul, which is one of the big oil-producing regions, and they started capturing oil fields when the United States was like, oh, shit. These guys are terrible. We gotta send troops back in and go recapture these oil fields, basically. They didn't say it like that, but that's basically what they did. But anyway, back to what we were saying. Mission creep, dude. They started with like 300 troops, and then it was like, okay, we're gonna send 500 more. I mean, you know, these are advisors, they're not boots on the ground, and then we're gonna send 500 more, we're sending 1,000 more, we're sending a couple hundred more. I mean, you're right. How many is it now? 10,000? I mean, tens of thousands? We don't know how many are over there. We've got boots on the ground in Syria as well already, maybe 1,000 troops over there. We don't know how many people are over there already. They don't tell us the full, you know, the full accounting of what's going on. But it's mission creep. And, you know, that would be the same thing as what would happen in Syria. They would say, okay, we're going to put a no-fly zone, and we got to send 1,000 guys in to make sure that it stays, you know, that it's safe. And then it's going to be like, oh, our guys came under attack. We got to send reinforcements. We got to send 10,000 more, 20,000 more. And then sooner or later, like the general said, we need 70 to 100,000 troops on the ground in Syria to hold down this no-fly zone. I mean, I literally can't believe that Hillary Clinton gets a pass on this stuff.
But you can't hold it down. War. You'll never hold it down. They're not going to allow that. It just continues to escalate until the fact where, listen, we're fighting in Russia's backyard. Do you know how stupid that is? Do you know how many times people said Napoleon and Hitler were both morons? Are we going to go down the same path? It's just ridiculous. We're going to throw everything we got at trying to dislodge Russia from this tiny country for a pipeline. And guess what? China's just taken the Philippines into their sphere. So how long before Japan's like, oh, crap, we're going to be by ourselves soon, and South Korea is going to get overrun right away. I mean, do people not see that the shift is actually taking away our resources? We're going to be fighting two fronts again, but it's not going to be like last time because we're not going to have a whole huge amount of allies. Europe's just going to give up. Look how close they are to it already.
Yeah, man. I mean, great point. I'm glad you brought that up because that's another thing that hasn't been talked about at all in the debates or very much at all in the presidential election at all is the fact that, you know, our foreign policy throughout on the Eastern Front, which is, you know, right now the South China Sea, that's falling into pieces too. And, you know, we've been covering, we just got a new writer on the anti-media, James Holbrooks. He's our Asia correspondent, and he's been covering what's going on in the Philippines and the South China Sea. And, dude, literally, just in the past month, we lost the Philippines to China. The Philippines has been basically our strongest ally in Asia since World War II, and before that even, because for a long time, they were kind of basically just a vassal state of U.S. foreign policy. I mean, we more or less kind of conquered the Philippines a long time ago, before World War II. The Japanese took it away from us. We took it back from Japan and quote-unquote liberated them, but we left them kind of as a vassal state where it's like, look, you guys, you know, we'll leave you alone for the most part. Just be friendly to us. Let us have our military all up in your country. And, you know, let us do whatever the hell we want to do, and we'll be fine. Now, the latest president in the Philippines, I don't like the guy. He's, you know, a drug warrior, and he's killing his own people, anyone accused of selling drugs and stuff. But that doesn't matter if I like him or not. He is snubbing the United States. He's shifting his alliance of the Philippines over to China, and he's in China right now. And just last night, we covered on the anti-media, there was protesters in Manila, which is the capital city of the Philippines, tried to storm the U.S. embassy because they're tired of having our military in their country, and they have never really had any benefits from it. And, you know, Philippines is in many ways a third world country. It deals with many of the same exact issues that Mexico deals with corruption, drugs, you know, poor economy, and many of the similar things that we deal with in Mexico. Philippines dealing with the same thing. And the United States has been their kind of protector for a long time. And the Philippines is resentful towards the United States because they haven't benefited from the partnership that they've had with them for a really, really long time. And so, you know, these protesters last night that tried to storm the American embassy in Manila, they were anti-American protesters, dude. They're trying to get U.S. troops out of the Philippines. And the president of the Philippines is fanning the flames. He's shifting his alliance to China. He called Obama a son of a bitch just a couple weeks ago. I mean, this guy is really going hard against the United States. So,
you know what a big part of it is, Nick, is that when we did conquer the Philippines because we had originally took them over in the late 1800s when we just kicked the Spanish Empire's butt, we killed their Muslim population because Teddy thought that they were going to be insurgents, so he just slaughtered them wholesale, like 2 million of them. And so there's always been the southern part of the Philippines that's Muslim has wanted to overthrow the government forever because they want U.S. out of there because of that. And now they've kind of done it through Duterte. I mean, Duterte maybe is an infiltrator, man. So, yeah, the Chinese did a coup d'etat in a way, and they got the Philippines, and it's a huge, huge problem for us now.
Yeah, it is. And you're right. One of the things that Duterte mentioned, actually, is that part of the, you know, because right now the Philippines has been dealing with an Islamic extremist kind of insurgency in the south for a really long time. As you mentioned, I mean, this has been going on for like over 100 years, but it's been getting worse and worse and worse. And, you know, ISIS now even has influence in the Philippines, in the South Philippines. But one of the things Duterte actually cited as far as trying to get U.S. military out of the Philippines is something that the political establishment refuses to acknowledge or believe, but it's kind of, for people that are actually have common sense, it's, you know, common knowledge at this point. He basically made the claim that, you know, part of the reason why there's this horrible Muslim insurgency, you know, with ISIS and terrorism and stuff down in the South, is because of the U.S. presence, the military presence down there. And so that's one of the first places where Philippines now is ordering the U.S. to start removing its military installation, removing its troops, is from the South to start trying to quell this Muslim insurgency that's going on down there. Because, you know, this multiple studies, in fact, one of the most recent ones we covered on the anti-media, and this was covered pretty widely by any anti-establishment media, including The Intercept, was that the main driver for homegrown extremism in the United States is the perception that we're committing atrocities around the world, whether it be in Yemen or Syria or Iraq or anywhere else in the Muslim world. Every time a bomb drops and we kill an innocent family, someone here in the United States that's already here that is probably just a normal person right now, a normal, regular Muslim that wants nothing other than what you and me want, which is to be free and to be left alone, they see that happening and they say, you know what? The United States is having an institutional war against Islam. Why else would they be bombing all these countries? Why else are they killing innocent children in drone strikes? I need to do something about this. And that's what motivates homegrown extremism in the United States, and that's what motivates terrorism all around the world. I mean, a lot of the rallying cry that Osama bin Laden used was the U.S. military presence in Saudi Arabia, in the Holy Land. You know, and that's the rallying cry. I mean, if the United States were open and honest about terrorism, they would sit back and they would say, you know what, terrorism is being created by us because we're doing stuff that people don't want us to do. But you know what, too damn bad, because their oil is too valuable and we need that revenue to keep our empire going. If they were honest about it, that would be one thing. But instead, they sit here and they, oh, no, we got to go spread freedom in Libya. We got to spread freedom in Syria. And we got to spread love and freedom in Iraq. Even if it involves killing a million people in Iraq, you know, we're just, all we're doing is spreading freedom and making sure they have great elections. You know, and that's the kind of thinking that people like Hillary Clinton want everybody to believe. Donald Trump, you know, George Bush, Barack Obama. I mean, all the crap they do overseas, which... the underlying issue is geopolitical, economic, hegemonic, and, you know, just crony capitalists. They operate under the guise of spreading freedom and love and democracy and greatness and stuff, and it's just, it's all bullshit. It's all bullshit. Now, Philippines is calling us on it, and they're trying to kick us out because we're destabilizing their country. And you know what? I think it's probably going to happen. And the other thing that I wouldn't be surprised about, because the president is already daring the United States to use the CIA to deal with him, you know, and so the United States can't afford to lose the Philippines alliance. So I wouldn't doubt if the CIA were to become involved to try to take care of Duterte and quell the, you know, organic anti-American sentiment, anti-imperialist sentiment that's been rising in the Philippines for a very, very long time. I mean, think about this. The Philippines has been a kind of a colony of several different empires for a long time. I mean, as you mentioned, DB, the Spanish were there first, and then the United States took over for a long time, and then the Japanese took us out, and they took over, and then we kicked them out, we took back over. I mean, the people of the Philippines are probably pretty tired of it, you know, and they're just like, you know what, how about all of you guys get the hell out of our way? And, you know, China is the one country in the region that really hasn't screwed them over too badly. And so that, and not only that, but a lot of the people in the Philippines are descendants of Chinese. So, you know, there's definitely cultural, ethnic ties there that make a lot more sense for the Philippines to be more closely aligned with China than it does with the imperialistic United States. And so, you know, that's what's going on right now. And that throws a wrench into the entire quote unquote Asian pivot, which is what has been a cornerstone of Obama's foreign policy for a long time. I mean, like you said, Japan is the only country left standing over there. And Japan is dealing, I don't know if you guys have been paying attention to this, but, you know, this isn't reported in the Western media very often either. But Japan is actually going through a cycle of anti-American imperialism as well. Protests by and we're not talking about like a couple thousand people. Hundreds of thousands, tens of thousands of people protesting outside of U.S. military bases in Japan. Japan is tired of our shit too. Like, the entire idea of this American empire that can assert itself in East Asia, that can assert itself in the South China Sea, that could assert itself in Syria and Iraq and all over the world, it's evaporating, dude. I'm, I, you know, people need to start bracing and preparing for the fact that the United States empire, it's in one way or another on the way out. Is it now what we have to decide at this point, and this is up to us. Are we going to let it get dragged down like the Nazi empire did and just go into ashes? Or are we going to let it, you know, just start pulling back like the British empire did, start pulling back, get out of India, get out of, you know, the Americas, get out of Canada and start just pulling back and say, okay, we got to let go of all these colonies, which, you know, we don't call them colonies anymore, but these are kind of like vassal states, South Korea, you know, the Philippines, Japan, a bunch of the countries over in Eastern Europe and stuff. We have to either start pulling back and saying, you know what, we spread ourselves too thin. We thought we could do too much, you know, start pulling it back, or are we going to go and start World War III and start the final battle of the empires? I mean, that's really the choice that we're dealing with right now, and neither one of these two candidates are going to fix that. The only thing that's going to fix that is the public opinion, and the people need to stand up and say, you know what? We don't want World War III. Let's start letting the empire slowly pull back from it and come back home, and let's deal with our own shit here, because you know what? We've got enough problems in the United States to deal with that we don't need to be all around the world policing the world anymore. I mean, that's the way I see it. I mean, Jake, what do you think, dude?
All we're saying is give peace a chance. That's all we're saying.
Seriously, dude. Let it, you know, let's see what happens with peace, because you know what? I mean, World War III or just a big war with Russia and maybe China, it's not going to look good for anybody.
Well, they don't care about that. I mean, the question is how they're going to throw in the next, kind of decade or two decade war machine, because they have to keep justifying these wars. But if they had a modicum of rationality, they would push the space program and justify spending all this money. Putting us in Mars, putting us on Europa, you know, really actually doing something to actually benefit the human race instead of this economic imperialism that's could kill millions, tens of millions, billions. I can't foresee the circumstances in which a nuclear weapon would be fired by a major superpower, but no one's ever going to see the circumstances beforehand. It's just going to happen. Like, there's going to be a standoff. Someone's going to make a mistake. Someone's going to do something stupid, and all of a sudden a nuke gets fired. And this is why people were so terrified during the Cold War. And this is arguably, like, more contentious than the Cold War, because these tensions have been brewing in the Middle East for, you know, over 15 years now.
Yeah, I mean, they've been going on. I'd argue that these tensions have been going on for like 100 years.
Yeah, of course.
Once the old empires, you know, the French and, you know, the British and everyone, like I said, you know, all these guys, you know, let's not forget, all these countries in Europe, they used to be empires too. France, Spain, England, Belgium, I mean, they all had empires too. Germany, Italy, you know, Libya used to be a vassal state of you know, a colony of Italy. You know, the French used to control Syria, and they used to control Vietnam, and, you know, England used to control half the world. So all of these people have kind of more or less kind of like pulled back, and in replace of that empire, they created NATO. And NATO is like, okay, let's, instead of having this huge empire where we have to go and like subjugate and like occupy countries, let's create more of an economic empire where, you know, we can use more surgical military actions to install friendly governments and make big, you know, corporate empires and stuff like that. And we all make money, and then we don't got to do all these horrible genocidal things that we've had to do throughout history. But I think that this age of empires is really coming to an end now with the liberalization of information. And, you know, the Arab Spring in many ways was partly manufactured by the U.S. and stuff. But in other ways, it was a product of the Internet and the freeing up of information. In fact, WikiLeaks is actually part of the reason that WikiLeaks is partially responsible for the Arab Spring and unveiling a lot of the evil doing that went on between a lot of those countries over there in the Middle East and the West, you know, and all that corruption and all the backdoor dealings and stuff. And the people got fed up with it. And so, you know, this information liberalization or liberation is probably a better word for it, is really, it should be leading us down this path of giving peace, truly giving peace a chance for once. Because throughout the history of civilization, I think that there's always been somebody there that wanted to take advantage of somebody else. I mean, there's been so many empires throughout history, and it's always somebody subjugating and stealing stuff from someone else. And right now, it just happens to be that the United States is the biggest one doing that with its partners in NATO, and it doesn't have to be that way. And that's why we need to, and again, it goes back to this idea of voting. It doesn't have to be done through the voting booth. It has to be done through public opinion. And that's the only way that things ever get changed. Look at marijuana legalization. I mean, it wasn't just like some politician. We didn't vote for Obama, and Obama comes in, you know, because looking back at, in 2008, Obama was like pretty open about marijuana legalization. In fact, he you know, some people who watched him closely would say he was in favor of marijuana legalization. Obama came in and he has more anti-marijuana arrests than Bush. But regardless of Obama, marijuana legalization is moving forward in the United States, state by state by state, county by county, city by city, because the public opinion is shifted, not because some politician, some hero, some, you know, messiah is coming out of the woodwork and saying, I'm going to free up everybody, I'm going to close the prisons, I'm going to get end the drug war. That's not how it happens. We don't have messiahs, we don't have heroes. That's on TV for the most part. What the real heroes are the people that are in their day-to-day lives spreading and helping change the public opinion, like all the people listening to the show tonight. Those people talking to their families, talking to their friends about issues and about understanding, you know, this new access to information that we have, shedding light on corruption, exposing these politicians for what they are, exposing these corporations for what they do. Those are the real heroes, man. And there's millions of them out there. And that's the way we win, is by changing the hearts and minds, not in the voting booth. And that's why I don't really am not that concerned about Trump or Clinton, other than the fact that these assholes start World War III, because I don't think that people are going to support it. I really don't. Maybe I'm wrong, but you know, maybe I'm being optimistic for once. But I think the people around in this country and around the world are finally ready to give peace a chance, because they're tired of fighting and dying and being in poverty, and fighting banker wars and fighting to make someone else rich. And it's time for us to use open source technology and information to start enriching ourselves and our communities and being more self-reliant, not having to rely on some politician or some government that's going to bullshit us every day of the week and tell us that we're going to go bomb and kill a million people in Iraq for freedom. I mean, that's the biggest lie, I think, in the modern political history, is Iraq, that we're going to go over there and Operation Iraqi Freedom is going to free up those people and give them democracy. The place is a wreck. It's corrupt to the core. I mean, the politicians there are so unpopular. And, you know, the reason ISIS was able to spread so quickly over there, part of the reason was because the government is so damn bad. It's not a democracy. We didn't give them any freedom. All we give them is suffering and misery. And we don't got to topple governments anymore and go in with bombs and drone strikes to give people freedom. All we have to do is help maintain the liberation of information, and the people will start finding it out on their own. And that's the other thing, too, that's so important. We can't come to some place and say, hey, dude, you guys need democracy, and if you don't believe in it, we're going to drop bombs on you until you believe in it. Because that's not how it works. You don't fix problems like that anymore, or ever. I don't know if that's ever worked. I don't think it has. But you know what? Despite historical evidence and whatever you want to call it, these assholes think you can still drop bombs and win hearts and minds like that. That's not how it works. People need to come to these conclusions on their own, and the only way that they can come to the conclusions is by getting access to information. And that's the biggest fight of our time, is to make sure that information stays free. And you know what? The people in charge don't want it to be. I mean, look at WikiLeaks. I mean, let's talk about WikiLeaks a little bit, man, because in my opinion, you know, I saw Glenn Greenwald give a little bit of a critique about, you know, they haven't done enough on redacting and protecting innocent people from being harmed by information and stuff. And I think that's a case to be made at another time. I think there is credence to that. But WikiLeaks is liberating information, and they're doing a great job of it. And it's shedding a light on this entire electoral system, the backdoor dealings, the corruption. And you know what? Trump or not, dude, I think people in this country are not giving credence to this election because they understand, they're starting to understand how corrupt it is. And for the longest time, these guys were able to control that information and keep it secret. You know, secrecy is the lifeblood of a oligarchy. You know, they need to keep secrets. Otherwise, the people find out all these horrible things they're doing and they're not secrets anymore. No one's going to believe their shit. And that's what's going on. Nobody believes what Hillary Clinton says. Nobody believes what Donald Trump says. Nobody believes what these politicians are telling us. I don't even think people believe what Obama's saying anymore, even though he's still a pretty popular guy. People are seeing through the bullshit finally and for once. And it's in many ways thanks to WikiLeaks, but in also many ways the internet and independent media. And that's why I'm so glad to have this radio show, and I'm so glad that we have people that actually listen to us talk. Because this is the lifeblood of the evolution, and I don't call it a revolution intentionally, because it's an evolution in what we need. And this information and the criticism and the exposing of corruption, that's what is going to help fix the world. It's not going to be bombs. It's not going to be Donald Trump. It's not going to be Bernie Sanders. It's definitely not going to be Hillary Clinton. It's not going to be any politician or any political party. It's the people talking, spreading information, understanding what's going on, breaking through the propaganda and the lies to start realizing that we don't need a lot of the stuff that they're telling us we need to do, like the war on terror, for instance.
And in the meantime, let's burn it down and deny these fools, opdeny.com. Deny them the ability to make this farce and this coronation go through and make the reps vote in one of these losers. And then we can recall the entire government and vote them all out. That'd be great. That's the whole goal, because this has just been a farce and a scam. And everybody that buys into it and everybody that goes and votes because, you know, you feel like you have to, you got to write in who you want. Just write in who you want.
That was one of the funny things at the end of the debate. The moderator at the end, he goes, "Well, one thing we can all agree on is that we want everybody to go out and vote." And that's the third tactic that I didn't get to talk about earlier, is the tactic of not voting. Now, you know, I do believe in voting for legislation and, you know, propositions and stuff like that that would actually increase freedom. Like, for instance, here in California in 2014, we passed some legislation that basically defelonized all drug possession. And that kind of stuff I believe in voting in, you know, marijuana legalization. If you're voting for something that's going to increase freedom, I think that may be something you may want to think about voting for. But when it comes to having to choose between Trump and Clinton, I think something that is more effective is depriving them of the vote so that we can sit back and say, look, you got elected with only 20% of the voting public. Obama got elected with only 29% back in 2012. I mean, with Clinton or Trump, whoever wins, how low is it going to be? 20%, 25% of the people actually voted for one of these guys?
I think it's supposed to be, it's projected to be like 12%.
So, you know, that's really, really low. And so that's a tactic in itself. To talk about not accepting the validity of an election, now to break away from Trump and say, well, it was stolen by Clinton, I don't know, you know, how that'll work or how that's going to happen. But in my opinion, the validity of the election should be gauged on how many people are actually voting. Because if people can't inspire, if you can't inspire 51%,
Stereo. This is Ozzy Skateboard,